welcome to the Fastcast. I'm Slowpoke number one, John Nicolaitis.
I'm Slowpoke number two, David Chalante.
And we're here today to talk about all the cool things that you want us to talk about.
It is listener question streak number three. We are 3 weeks in a row with these great, great questions from our great, great listeners.
But before we get to those questions, David, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good. PAX tickets have gone on sale since the last time you and I sat down to record. And I have seen the link and seen the email and seen the promotion on the Facebook groups I follow, all that kind of thing. You see these notifications everywhere. And every time I go to click on the link, I'm just reminded of that fucking shit-eating tweet that Gabe put out a little while ago about Far Cry 5. Did you see that?
Oh, no. I think I've burnt this one from my mind. I know that there is a tweet, but I feel like there's a space where I've cut it out.
Yeah, so we did an episode a while back about the Penny Arcade comic that insulted Polygon and their reviews. And it was just like, if Polygon says something bad, then the game's actually great and I'm going to buy it immediately. Mike Krahulik said that about Far Cry 5. So he tweeted something like, Polygon says that Far Cry 5 is bad, I bought it immediately, right? And it's just, even the comic, it's one of those things where it's just like, that's not super professional, that's kind of juvenile, and you're kind of taking a dig at a progressive media outlet, but whatever, gamers are going to be gamers.
Yeah,
but to go after the backlash, you can't claim it was all in good fun at that point. At that point, you know that you're kind of being a bit bullying about it.
So I
keep thinking about that, and it was one of those things that when I read it at the time, I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, can Penny Arcade just get a social media manager, please, so I can at least ignore this kind of shit when I think about PAX?
David, the President of the United States doesn't have a social media manager. I don't know how Penny Arcade is going to get one, okay? Right? No one's managing his tweets.
Yeah. I mean, except when they very, very obviously are. But anyway, like, I was thinking about that recently because I've been reading a little bit more about Far Cry 5.
Yeah.
And my God, does that sound fucking bad. Like, I haven't played it, but fuck me, does it sound bad. Like, really, really fucking bad in pretty much every way.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah.
Actually, I read a really interesting article that Matt Lees shared, which was basically about how, oh yeah, sure, it's a great game, but stop saying that, it doesn't do anything with its message.
Yeah, so there's that part of it, right? It doesn't do a lot with its message. And again, I have not played it myself. I'm never fucking going to, based on what I've read here. But a couple of people that I respect and follow, namely some people from fucking Polygon, have talked about, firstly, the gameplay is some of the worst that's been in a Far Cry game since, like, Far Cry 2. A lot of the convenience is gated behind artificial level ups that just make the game very frustrating to play. So on that front, It's a frustrating game just from a gameplay perspective. Mm. Apparently, it also doesn't do a lot with its message. It's very cowardly and kind of, no sides and very bland in that regard.
What's the way to phrase it? It's like it dresses up in costumes of things it doesn't want to say anything about.
Yeah. And beyond that, apparently it has really bad issues with tone. So I don't know how specific I'm going to want to get into this, but there are points where it has this wacky, over-the-top, stupid violence tone, and one of the examples that stands out to me is there's a point where you drive, like, a combine harvester or something like that to mush up cows and harvest their testicles for the cow testicle parade that's going to go on later that day or some shit.
Ah, yes. Clever humor.
Yeah, it's fucking irreverent, am I right? It's just so off the wall. But that's also mixed in with, like, the most fucking bleak, grim, dark shit. And I'm actually going to drop a content note for this.
Ooh, okay,
cool. I'm about to talk about infant mortality. There's an example of a scene where, like, two members of the death cult have a baby and they're expecting the baby to die, but the baby doesn't die. And so they suffocate the baby to, like, match up with their whole death cult beliefs or whatever, and it's just the most grotesque, upsetting shit for no fucking reason. And like everything I read about this and every podcast I listen to about it is just like, what the fuck are you guys doing? When you announced this premise, I had so much hope.
Yeah.
I had so much hope, and it's just, you've pissed it away into nothing and just made this grotesque pile of garbage. And I fucking hope that Gabe is just eating his fucking words. Like, I know that my reaction, I'm going to take a step back because I'm actually getting quite agitated here.
Yeah, take a deep breath.
Yeah, but all of these things put together, like, I think about all of that shit every single time I go to buy a fucking PAX ticket, and that sucks because PAX is actually pretty nice.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I actually super like PAX and the Diversity Lounge and the cool shit that they do, but I'm really reluctant to buy a fucking ticket.
Well, yeah, no, David, I've already bought us 2 EB Prestige tickets for PAX this year.
What? Fuck yes, we're the realest gamers. We're going to have the most exclusive gamer coverage in the Gamer Lounge.
Yep. That sounds great.
Yeah, that was a thing, actually. Do you want to talk? I mean, EB Expo is now part of PAX. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know anything about the EB Expo. It just sounds like a giant EB game store. And every time I look into it and read up on it, it just sounds like a giant EB game store.
Yeah, it makes sense, right? Because now they can do their EB specific shit and not have to organize any of the convention specific shit because PAX will have already done it for them. Like, it just. Win-win. Like, I guess there are people in Sydney who are a bit bummed out because there's one fewer expo up there now, which, I mean, I can definitely sympathize with that.
And also, like, to be real, you know, I despise capitalism because I'm a damn commie, but people enjoy buying stuff, so there should be a place for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I used to be a lot more resistant to EB games when I was all like, oh, they shaft the developers by making secondhand sales and all that kind of thing. I have a much more consumer-focused opinion now, and so, yeah, sure, trade-ins are definitely still shafting you because they pay you, like, 5% of what they go on to sell that secondhand shit for.
Yep.
But on the whole, it's just like any other fucking store. Like, I'm not overly angry at EB Games for selling games. Like, there are much less ethical business practices.
Yeah, they could have not sold a $500 real gamer ticket, though, because it kind of sounds a bit much.
Yeah, like, that's fucking wanky, but at the same time, that's not deforestation. You know, that's more what I'm getting at.
David,
like,
you're
sure, they're getting people who are way too enthusiastic and way too stupid with their money to spend money on something, but they're not, like, securing water sources in third world countries that are unstable using private military companies like Coke and Nestle do.
Yeah,
like,
I will take every opportunity to bash Nestle and Coke for doing actual evil
shit. Fuck you, Nestle, and fuck you, Coke.
Monsters! Oh boy, what a tangent.
Yeah, so I'm feeling fine, I guess. Now that I've got to just vent a little bit. And now I feel like now that I've had this conversation, I can buy a PAX ticket because I've processed that emotion between you, John, and you, dear listener. So thank you for being my unpaid therapists there. And now I can go and enjoy a video game convention.
David, anytime I can spend hours editing your therapy session into something a listener can enjoy. This is truly...
That is way too close to true. That is way, way, way too real.
Let's not discuss how art can be therapy when you just push it into people's ears. You know what, David? I've been doing pretty swell. I went to a talk about creating narrative podcasts.
Yes,
and it's
got
me.
I could not go to this, but I'm very, very interested to hear your thoughts on it.
It got me very excited to make more stuff. The speaker was James Parkinson, who hosts a podcast called By Association, which is a football podcast.
That is a good name for a football podcast.
Yeah, it is. And it's the football in the global sense, not the Aussie rules sense.
Yeah.
And in this talk, basically, there's a Melbourne podcast sort of association and they run monthly talks. They do a podcast that I will link to, although they only put one episode up at the moment. And it was just talking about how to produce a narrative podcast by yourself. And the most interesting thing I learned was how James actually transcribes the podcast into text and then rearranges that text to help craft the story.
Yeah.
And then when that happened, I like beautiful minded and like it all suddenly made sense. And I was
Oh. It's one of those things that seems really obvious now that you've said it. Like for a narrative podcast specifically, for what we do, that would not work at all because the conversation is much too natural for that.
That was as that conversation just was. I just look at the text and be like, that's exactly what we said, isn't it? I'll just remove all the swearing.
But yeah, for a narrative podcast, that's a great idea. I will briefly say here, John is very excited about creating new things. I'm very excited about creating new things. We are not promising that we're going to make a narrative podcast. They are very, very difficult. And the main reason we were interested in that talk was to see how we could improve the shows that we already do, as well as expand into some other things. But please, dear listener, we do not want you to be disappointed. So take everything we say here as speculative rather than like exploratory.
Okay. And now that David has like totally ruined your expectations, like, I want to be clear. I want to make more stuff. We both want to make more stuff. It just has to come. No, it doesn't have to come at the cost of our own lives. And so if we can make more stuff, hopefully we can. That'd be great.
So I feel like we've talked enough about inside baseball and the behind the scenes structure of our show.
Oh, definitely.
Should we perhaps move into the questions that our fine listener has asked of us?
Yes, we will go and talk about what you, the listener, want to hear.
Perfect. All right.
Oh, God. Why did I phrase it like that? As we enter the first question, David, can you give it to me?
Right. Yeah, no, I just tweaked what you're getting at here.
Yep.
So the reason John's a little bit awkward here is because the first question is one we can't answer.
We're the worst at answering questions.
This is a question from Rhett, and he asked, if you're recording an episode for Spec Ops The Line, I'm very interested in knowing what you think about this game.
Ooh.
Now, this wasn't so much a direct question. This was in response to us sharing a deal on Spec Ops The Line.
Yeah.
There are two reasons that we can't do an episode on Spec Ops The Line, and the first is that we both played it long before we did the podcast.
Yeah, and because of the premise of the show where we kind of, at least one of us is catching up on something we haven't played, it doesn't really fit there.
Yeah, it doesn't fit our niche. It doesn't fit our artistic vision.
You know, our beautiful grand vision that's just perfect and pure. That's exactly what I meant.
But let's be honest. The real reason we can't do an episode on Spec Ops The Line is because it would take 6.5 hours.
Yeah,
Spec Ops The Line straight up is one of the best games ever made. There's a lot of pushback in recent years against it because something's super popular and a couple of years later, everybody gets super revisionist about it. And it's all like, oh, actually, it's cool to dislike that thing that used to be popular 3 years ago. So there's a little bit of that. There's also a fact that games that use the medium of games uniquely to explore themes that can only be done in this medium are less sparse than they were at the time when Spec Ops The Line came out. Despite those things, it is still incredibly, amazingly good at what it does and still totally 100% fucking relevant.
But to me, David, the problem is that I have 5 minutes of things to say and you have hours of things to say.
Yeah, like straight up, like I could talk for hours about that game. It does so much so well, and even just the little things it does well are still incredible. Like, it's probably the best performance that Nolan North has ever given in a game by far, to the point where you kind of have to remind yourself that Nolan North is the main character in this game.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when Jim Carrey does like a really compelling drama and you're like, oh wait, that's Truman from the Truman Show.
Yeah, or Jim Carrey, the anti-vaxxer from real life.
Yeah. Vaccinate your children, folks.
Yes, please vaccinate. I wanted to mention it because it's a really interesting game. I think we both would just unequivocally be like, if you like thinking about games, if you want to play something really interesting and well put together, definitely give Spec Ops The Line a try. I'm sure you can get it for a pittance now, especially.
Yeah. I will also say this, a brief disclaimer on it. It's not immediately fun to play. The gameplay loops of it aren't perfect. And I don't normally say this to people, but please stick with it because it is fucking great.
And it also came out in that time of right in the cover shooter zone.
Yeah. Not like that we've when left everything it too much. Wanted to be a COD clone and that kind of thing.
Gears of War as well and that kind of stuff. Mm. So it does have a lot of roots there. I do feel it's still slick enough to be okay to play. I have replayed it recently.
I want to say so much about the gameplay and why it's really good
The
stuff that we're talking about, but I can't. It'll take me forever. But check it out. It is an amazingly intelligent game.
Just quickly, if you do want to hear some of David's thoughts, maybe you should annoy him on Twitter, at SlowpokesCast, and he will be unable to control himself and will write about it.
Hang on a second. I'll be right back. I just need to delete my Twitter account.
No, don't, David. Don't. That's our Twitter account. You can't delete it.
Sorry, what Twitter account? I'm pretty sure it's been deleted.
No.
So because we weren't able to answer Rhett's question on Spec Ops The Line, we will actually go ahead and answer another question that he submitted to us.
Yep.
And that is, what classic video game soundtracks do you want released on vinyl? John, I will throw this question to you.
So when I hear a question like this, you think about the whole immensity of every video game you've ever played, and video games are flying past me, and I'm like, how do they sound? I don't remember how any of them sound, David. I don't know what video games sound like. But then there's this one pure sound sort of comes out of the blue. And for some reason, I do not know why, if I could have one game soundtrack on vinyl, it would be the original StarCraft soundtrack.
So, okay, I'm going to be a little bit agitated with you, John. You said that this was going to be really obscure and out of left field. Everyone knows what StarCraft is. Yeah, I was expecting it to be like Fantasy World Dizzy or something like that.
Well, when I said it was like odd, I feel like it's an odd choice to pull a soundtrack from.
Yeah,
right?
I can kind of see that, but I'll also say this.
Yeah.
That kind of makes sense to me for a couple of reasons. The first is it's an RTS that doesn't have a dynamic soundtrack. So it's just music, right? And because it's an RTS, takes a while to play if you're playing it single player. So you hear those three or four tracks for each army a lot, right?
Yeah.
And so it doesn't surprise me that it makes a sort of a strong impression on you.
I played StarCraft and I played in the StarCraft level editor and I created maps in there for basically all of my primary school years.
Yeah, because the other thing too is it is one of those games that came out when you and I were at that age where it was like, you would get obsessed with a game, like, and just play it nonstop.
And I think the next game would be Diablo for pretty similar reasons.
Yeah.
Like, these games, they're just so classic to me. If I was going to have one game soundtrack, it would probably be, like, one classic video game soundtrack, I'd say. If I was going to get something more modern, I would probably get something like The Beginner's Guide would be a good example of something not only would I want to have the soundtrack of, but have it on vinyl as that kind of little extra step of having a nice object. A game like The Beginner's Guide and the music in there means a lot to me. And so having that as a vinyl would be important.
Yeah, see, when I read this question, there were two things that really jumped out at me. So I'll start off very basically. I'm not a big music person. We've said that in the past. But there's two things that jump out at me here. The first is it's a classic video game, and the second is that it needs to be released on vinyl. So the question is not, what's your favorite soundtrack? What do you like listening to? But what would you like to see released on vinyl? And to me, the relationship with music that I have is not the kind where I want it on a tangible object necessarily.
Yeah.
Like, I don't feel that physical connection with music, for want of a less wanky way to put it. You know what I'm getting at?
Yeah,
like,
you feel a digital connection to music as it stimulates your electronic hearing devices.
Yeah, like, I know that you're joking when you say that, but my relationship with music is listening to it, not having it. Yeah? And so whatever version of it gives A, the most convenience, and B, the most fidelity, and vinyl is one of the worst forms for both of those things. The other part of it too is classic video game soundtracks, and this is where I also kind of deviate from the question a little bit, because there aren't really any classic video games that really stand out to me as having good music. And it's also like, what do you call classic? Like, I don't know if I would call StarCraft a classic game. You know, is classic a game that was like landmark, in which case we could consider anything right up to, like you said, The Beginner's Guide or Super Mario Odyssey could theoretically be a classic game because it's an instant classic, you know? Or do you mean like retro? Do you mean stuff that has that literally like 8-bit, 16-bit chiptune soundtrack?
Yeah.
I remember a video from Extra Credits, which we'll probably link in the description, about music and how it's changed and people being like, why isn't music as good now as it was back in the old days? And one of the main things that they talked about that makes music memorable is a strong, memorable melody. And because you have in a 16-bit tune or whatever, you only have enough notes at a time to create a single chord. So all of your music has to be basically just melody. And that's the memorable thing. But music from today is fully orchestral.
Yeah, it could be as complex as a musician wants it to be, or a composer.
Yeah, and like when we get into questions like that of fidelity, like Halo 1, which was released, I think, in 2001, that's got an amazingly good soundtrack. In Halo 1, all MIDIs, the whole soundtrack is all MIDI soundtrack. So
yeah.
It's not a real orchestra. It's all synthesized, right? If you put that on vinyl, would that degrade the quality of the music? I don't know enough about music, right? Yeah. But if you put like the Witcher 3 soundtrack or something really modern that's played in front of a full orchestra and everything, it definitely would degrade it. And so, I don't know. I think there's a lot to think about in that question. What's a classic video game soundtrack? Is it defined by technology or is it defined by impact? Is it defined by era? When they say, do you want it on vinyl, do they mean as like an art piece in your home or to actually listen to? Like, I don't know. I'm having a lot of fun asking questions about that question.
David, can you never answer a question straight? You've always got to...
No.
Think about things.
I'm too bendy.
I think you're right. Like, you know, what does that mean? And there's a lot of depth there. But I just feel like I have a lot of answers now. Just remembered last night I might have had an encounter with a listener, and we stayed up late into the night drinking and playing video game music. And one of the songs we played was from Bully, which was a wonderful game that I personally really enjoyed.
They did have a good soundtrack for such a game that disappeared so quickly.
And I have replayed Bully recently, and there's something about it, and there's something about it being about school. It reminds me of this kind of Harry Potter-esque feeling of it resonates with a part of my life, and the music captures that for me. It ties all those emotions together. So yeah, I think that would probably be another example of a game that I'd have that soundtrack on, especially on vinyl, because it's a game that means a lot to me. It captures several points in my life, not only as a video game and me emotionally, but I played that game for the first time at the request of an ex of mine, and we played through that whole game together. So it has personal resonance on top of that. And having that as like a physical piece of vinyl just like completes this trifecta of what I would call, this is what I want from objects in my home, right?
Yeah.
I want them to serve a purpose or to have proper emotional resonance.
And I think that's part of the reason I was so hung up on the vinyl thing, because I think the real question specifically about it being vinyl is, what soundtrack do you have such an attachment to that you want to reify it? What soundtrack means so much to you that you want to turn it into a physical object that occupies space in your home? Mm. Not necessarily, you know, to put onto a gramophone and listen to. And the only soundtrack I think that I comes close to that for me is Journey, not just because it's a fucking incredible soundtrack, but it's a very similar situation to what you said, that I played that with a intimate partner at the time. And so it means a lot. That experience means a lot to me. When it comes to the memories and stuff that we attach to music, a lot of people are a little bit dismissive of nostalgia. And I think that it's important to be aware of when nostalgia plays a part in your attachment to things. But it's totally legit to have good memories and want those good memories to be a part of your life, like in a day-to-day way.
Yeah, of course.
And so the concept of getting something like that and putting it in your home, I totally understand. And I really do understand that attachment to not just music of games, but, you know, games in general and any kind of art, especially from earlier in your life.
Yeah.
That all said, like, I think that the most emotionally resonant, like the most emotional attachment I have to music is not from the retro era or the classical era of video games, whatever the classical era of video games is.
That's a whole other issue.
Yeah, it's from more recent stuff that I appreciate in a more adult way. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
In general, I have a much deeper appreciation for games that are more recent, not just because games are getting better, but I'm getting better at understanding them and appreciating them. And I think that I'd be a lot more likely to attach myself to music from a more recent game because of that.
I think it's also important to think about the context of video games existing mostly for us in a 30-year window. So, you know, classic for us can be really close. So I think Journey's a perfect example of a soundtrack to have as vinyl. I'm really happy with how we... Let's take a moment to pat ourselves on the back, because I really enjoyed that question.
Yeah, that was a really good question. We went a lot of places with it. So, Rhett, thank you very much for asking that.
Yes.
And I hope that makes up for us not answering your previous question.
Just tweet David. It's fine. Just
tweet
him.
The non-existent Slowpokes account. Okay, so our next question is from Julian. And that question is, why did The Walking Dead Season 2 fail to meet my extremely unnecessarily discerning expectations of a choose-your-own-adventure? Now, yes. I'm very proud of myself that I got through that question without stumbling it. That's a very well-worded question, Julian. But honestly, I mean, John, have you played The Walking Dead Season 2?
So the reason why I wanted to answer and talk about this question was I started playing Season 2 of The Walking Dead.
Okay.
I did not finish it.
Have you played Season 1?
Yes, I've actually played Season 1 multiple times.
Yeah, I've played Season 1 once. I have not played anything else in The Walking Dead. I'm assuming this is the Telltale Walking Dead, that we're talking about here?
Yeah, I've played Season 1, and I've played the mini episode as well as the start of Season 2.
I also have not played 2, so I can't really answer this question too specifically, but it is an excuse to talk about Telltale, because we're at an interesting point in Telltale's identity, yeah?
Yeah.
For a while, they made very generic classic adventure games where you filled up an inventory, you rubbed your inventory on shit until it unlocked, and then you went further forward in the game.
An infinite amount of Sam and Max games, more than any human being could ever want.
So they also had some other games where they started to do their licensing thing of movie properties and shit at that time that falls into that zone. So the Jurassic Park adventure game is an example of that, and the Back to the Future adventure game is an example of that.
The Back to the Future one stands out the most to me.
Yeah, and both of them are good. So, well, okay, I'll rephrase. Back to the Future is a good game. I hated Jurassic Park. I don't know why I said that was good. But they still fall into that era of Telltale. Then they made The Walking Dead Season 1, and fucking, not everything, but a lot changed about how they made games. They went from an adventure game to a choose your own adventure game. They went from that to the interactive narrative. And when they did that, they became the best in the business at it for a long time. I have been playing a lot of Telltale's games recently because of that announcement not too long ago that they are shifting their focus once again, that they're, I think, still making the same types of game, but doing it less frequently, doing it much more focused and trying to make things much higher quality.
Yeah.
And I think that that's interesting because I don't know what their business model is like, but since that announcement, I've been going back through a lot of their more recent games like Guardians of the Galaxy, Batman Seasons 1, Batman Season 2, and those three series are fucking great. They're really, really good.
I mean, it just reminds me of when we went back to Tales from the Borderlands and how enjoyable that actually was to play.
Yeah, they make games that are really well written, have a really strong sense of character voice, and although there are gameplay criticisms to be laid at the games, they're over-relying on QuickTime events, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
They still, I think, really capture the atmosphere of what it is they're making, and they have a strong thematic sense of where they're going in most cases. Now, Game of Thrones, I think, is their most obvious failing at that. It really started to unravel. But like I said, I just finished Telltale's Batman Season 2, like, not even a week ago, and fuck me, it was so good.
Hey, like, is that the one where they retell the Joker origin story?
Yes, definitely the answer to that question is yes. But what I, like, they do this really well in Season 1 and in Season 2. They recontextualize a lot of the villains in really interesting ways.
Oh, well, that's the best part about Batman.
And I don't
want to
ruin it,
then.
But, like, one example is the in Season 1, Episode 1, the Penguin shows up, and rather than him being like a stuffy aristocratic character, he's someone who was born rich but had his riches like taken from him due to, you know, a rival family and all that kind of shit. And now he's like this charming anarchist character. And I know that, like, on paper that just sounds very, oh, look, they're retelling the story and they made it a charming anarchist. But the way that they present these characters are super interesting. And I kind of didn't want to talk about the Joker because the Joker is so big and important in, like, the Batman canon that the less I say about him, the better. But that is also really good. And like anything, there are elements of it that are problematic, but there's some really, really good stuff with the Joker.
It just looked like they were doing something interesting, and that was the most exciting part to me.
Yeah, but it is. It's really interesting.
So Telltale's, they've made heaps of awesome games.
Yes, that is the point that we're getting at here. Telltale have made a huge amount of amazing games, and I am definitely going to be playing The Walking Dead Season 2 because I've tapped out on everything else. I've been avoiding it because it is the most emotionally trying of the things that they make. Mm-hmm. And I've never actually watched The Walking Dead because I don't want to engage with something that is emotionally exhausting. But The Walking Dead Season 1, like I said, I played that when it came out and I saw how it transformed where Telltale was going with things, and it was really fucking good. So, Julian, without knowing how it failed to meet your expectations of what that was? We can't really answer that question, but all I can really say is that for all the other Telltale games I played recently, all of them have really thoroughly impressed me with the choose-your-own-adventure style that they're going with, to the point where, like, you know, you finish one of these games, you don't think you're going to replay it, so you go read the wiki and see what the other choices are. And my expectation with a lot of choices in games like this now is that they're all illusions, right? Oh, I'll choose this thing, but 15 minutes later, something will happen that puts it back on the path it was going to be on anyway. The whole final episode of Batman Season 2 is entirely different based on some of the choices that you make. Like, there are some very consequential decisions that you make in all of the ones that I've been playing recently, and we're talking about, like, major characters dying permanently and that kind of thing.
My only thing that I would raise is I feel like they learnt lessons after Walking Dead 1 and 2 to not lie to people.
Yeah, maybe that's why I'm enjoying these more recent ones so much, and it might also be why they felt overburdened with the complexity of the more recent games that they've made, because there is so much more shit they have to make when they do these choices in a much more consequential manner. So maybe that's got something to do with it as well. But again, neither of us have played this one.
Yeah,
so
I picked this because I wanted to talk about why I stopped playing Season 2. But ultimately, I'm only left with a whole bunch of really reductive answers that are basically along the lines of, I got bored of it and it wasn't that interesting to me. Like the first half of the first episode was interesting and then I stopped playing. And I can't, I have to go back to it to find out why.
Yeah, I think that one of the things I'm most surprised by the more recent Telltale games, you know, Tales from the Borderlands, Batman Season 1 and 2, Guardians of the Galaxy, is that everything about them is higher quality than the ones I'm more familiar with, those early Walking Deads and whatnot. When it comes to, like, I got bored and I don't really know the answer why, every element of quality contributes to that. And I think that, like, one of the things that I'm constantly being re-surprised by with Telltale is every one of their games gets better in every one of these ways.
Well, I think that kind of answers our feelings on why feelings about Telltale could be,
I think we answered the questions adjacent to your question.
Yeah, that's good enough. I'll go that. A question was answered. I'll accept that. Maybe one day we'll play The Walking Dead, like David says, and we'll understand it a bit better to really answer it. But for now, that will do.
Yeah, so maybe when I undelete the Twitter account, I might have a little bit of a thread on it after I've actually finished it. I might tweet as I play, actually. Yeah. That might be fun.
Yeah, do that. That'd be great. Our next question is from Thomas, and it is, are there any board games you think would be worth playing as video games? Have any experience playing online board games? Any games you think would work better digitally than not?
Thank you for that question, Tom. So there's quite a lot to talk about there. Let's start very basic.
Yep.
I'm not super into board games anymore. So it's very rare that I can think of a board game off the top of my head that would work better as a video game or would be worth video gamizing.
Yeah.
For the sake of this question, John, do you think that Tom's asking us for, like, strict translations or, like, adaptations?
So in my mind, actually, that's a great question. I don't actually
Are we talking about just digitizing a board game, or are we talking about, like,
you said that to me.
Making a board game in the world.
Yeah, you said that to me, and I thought I'd be like, oh, yeah, no, it's obviously just board games on the internet. And I was like, oh, but that's just, no, it could be anything. I think in this instance, for this first part, we'll keep it more towards the structure of board games rather than a pure adaptation, because I think that video games can be inspired by board games to make better games and make simpler, more interesting games that have better choices. But I don't feel like that's the spirit of the question.
Yeah, I agree. And I think for the sake of simplicity, it's probably best we just stick to, hey, would you like to play Tsuro, but on a computer?
Yeah, and I have played, to answer the second part of this question first, I have actually played a few board games online. There's actually a website called BoardGameArena.com. Because it's on the internet, John. Oh my God, why did you say .com? Everyone knows .com usually follows. Keep going. So I've actually played some board games on there, and I've actually played a few like what I would call not like, you know, Tsuro is a great example of a rather like simplistic kind of board game to replicate because it's a bunch of tiles and moving pieces. But I've played a few more complex games with numbers of pieces, and I found that experience to be rough. Oh boy. Because when you're emulating a board game on a computer, you get into this situation where it's like, oh, how do I discard this card? I can't get it out of my hand. Or, yeah. Oh, what's the...
You can't just do a thing. You have to figure out the arguments you need to make to the computer to get the computer to do the thing.
Yeah, I swear sometimes I would like to be able to just write code for it because I just feel like the interfaces can be very clunky, especially when you're translating board games straight online. I find them to be really clunky. That being said, though, I have played some Android versions of popular board games.
Hmm.
For example, I've played the Galaxy Trucker app, which kind of takes the basis of Galaxy Trucker game, keeps it very similar, but gives it a sort of structure that's not in the base game, but that kind of can only be there in a phone version because it gives you lots of different mission requirements and expansions and other stuff like that. Just throws them all in there and it really streamlines the experience for solo play.
I think that you've hit the nail on the head there with what the issue is. The question, I think, for me about whether a game is better digitally or physically is whether or not that makes it more streamlined or less. And the only other thing that like really stands out to me as relevant is the difference between playing a game with someone face to face or playing with them online. So like the big thing about a board game is you get a bunch of people together in the same room and you have like that social contact.
Yeah.
And when you translate a game to work, not necessarily digitally, but definitely over the internet, you lose that. And so a game like Scrabble works fine with that because you can have asymmetrical turns. Mm. You're not necessarily waiting. Like Words with Friends is the game I'm trying to think of, which is just basically a phone app version of Scrabble. That works better because it fits around your lives. Yeah. But you lose all of that contact when you play a game like that. And because Scrabble is kind of dry, it doesn't necessarily need it. But if we were to play, what was the one that you and I played recently? The dating game.
Oh, yes. It's Jacob Jaskavy's Fog of Love.
Fog of Love. Like, Fog of Love would not work over the internet. It just wouldn't.
I think that you can play games online, but it would just ruin what was interesting about them.
And when you actually get games that rely on that social interaction, like The Resistance and all of that kind of thing, they just completely fall apart without that interaction.
Yeah.
Now, what I would like to see, I was thinking about this earlier today when you sent me the question list. The convenience of digitizing something is that it speeds shit up. You don't have to roll as many dice. You don't have to determine as many random factors. You don't have to organize as many decks.
Oh, the decks. So many decks.
Yeah. What I would love to see more of is apps that accompany a board game. Mm-hmm. So you put a phone on the side and you still have all of the stuff that needs to be physical and that social interaction because you're all still in the same room. But rather than being like, okay, so we need to draw two cards from this deck and one card from this deck and then the weather needs to change and then we have to randomly assign the influence points to everyone. Okay, cool. Now we're back to our next turn. You can just hit one button and it just does it all.
So
to have that accompany the board game and keep shit moving faster, but without losing all of the boons of that physical sort of single room play experience.
Yeah. Now, David, see, what you've described there is a wonderfully beautiful thing that simplifies a game experience and allows people to just get into playing with their friends more. That is rarely what happens when you introduce an app into a board game. There's a few that do it pretty well. I think Mansions of Madness 2nd Edition, while I've recently played a game of it and it was rough because we did a murder mystery and it was not the best use of that app, it streamlines games in a really interesting way because it doesn't require you to enter a lot of stuff. A lot of board game apps that I have read about and heard about actually ask you to add all the stuff into it that's happening on the physical board.
Yeah, that's the worst way to do it.
Yeah.
Ugh, that's really clunky.
The thing I was thinking of was, oh, maybe like those big games, those really big games, you do them digitally. But for me, playing a massive game of Twilight Imperium wouldn't feel the same if I couldn't look my friend in the eye and say, your planets are now mine.
Yeah.
Or if five turns later, everyone around the table literally gets up and starts screaming with joy as they all have joined together to defeat me. I think that's what I look for in board games, right? I want that intimacy. And I feel like video games occupy a more solo experience for me.
Yeah.
Or they also kind of occupy a sporting place for me. Like with team-based shooters and stuff like that, and MOBAs, that has a more of a going down, kicking the ball around. I think of board games and games that are trying to emulate board games, and I feel like you can't just directly translate them all the time, because to me, board games are about that presence of people.
Yeah. What's that thing Douglas Adams said about books, that sharks are still around because they're the best thing at being sharks, and books are still around because they're the best thing at being books?
Yeah.
I think that there's always going to be a place for board games that have a tangible sense of space and connection with other players. Like,
yeah.
Even if we do fully digitize the actual interactions with the game, like you have a completely holographic board and, you know, you move everything around by doing fucking Minority Report bullshit when we all have holograms on our tables and whatnot.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that you actually still come together and play in a physical space, I think, is going to be important. And the fact that there is some level of tactile interaction with what you're doing is going to be relevant.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking of, like, what's the one? Settlers of Catan.
Yeah.
You could keep track of all of your resources on paper, like just writing it down rather than having cards. I think there's something about physically trading the items that makes that feel so much more connected than if you were just like, oh yeah, cool, I'll take two wood off my sheet and you can write two extra wood on your sheet, even though that's probably a simpler way to keep track of the resources.
So Settlers of Catan is a really great game to pick, because I've actually played a lot of Settlers of Catan by myself on an app. I've even played a lot of popular train game.
Oh, Ticket to Ride?
Thank you. Yeah, I've played a lot of... I was just gesturing off towards a picture.
I can't see you.
I know. But you still saved me anyway, David. So I played a lot of Ticket to Ride sort of against bots by myself and had a really wonderful experience. But when I think about a game like Splendor, that's kind of arcadey, like Ticket to Ride and Settlers of Catan can be, I still don't want to play that on my phone, because that's a game I want to grow and experience with my friends, and I don't want to outskill them, because I'm aware that I'm the guy in my group of friends who has a lot of board games, and so if I just sat there playing them by myself, I'd just become the best. So they kind of
and
just...
And that fucking sucks.
Yeah,
and that fucking sucks when you finally get like four or five people together in a room and you just destroy them, and you're just like, well, this isn't why I wanted you guys over here, and now you're never going to want to play with me again.
Yeah, I didn't want to just... If I wanted to beat you, I'd get you to play video games in the comfort of your own home, because I'm the best at video games. I want you to beat me in board games to feed my masochism in person. So, like, I don't want to get the practice in. I'm aware of the meta of the skill level between my friends. So I want to savor that experience of playing them in person. I think there are ways to play board games. And like that website I mentioned before, that's a way to play board games online. And maybe you have a Skype window. You can like simulate that experience. But it always just comes back to that thing of, I just would rather play them in person.
Yeah. Something we haven't mentioned as well is like the restrictive nature of a digital game. Every rule is specified and has to be followed in a digital game. Whereas with a board game, you can home rule stuff. If you're playing a game and you guys don't really know what the best outcome is, or you decide, hey, hang on a minute, why can we only trade with between player A and player B? Why can't we do like a three-way trade and get player C in on this? Stuff like that helps keep everybody kind of engaged. And makes the game, it flows a lot better and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I have such a perfect example of that. When we were playing the aforementioned kind of terrible Mansions of Madness 2nd Edition, you can only do one puzzle move per point of brain. And that would mean you'd have to spend turn after turn after turn standing there to solve a puzzle. And we were just like, no. You just solve the puzzle and we will finish it and it's done. We don't have to waste our time doing this.
Yeah, exactly.
Take a shortcut.
Like having these little ways to make the game easier for you or more fun for you, or to match like your specific play style and needs between your group, I think is a big part of why board games fucking rule.
Yeah.
I think it's like the thing we've been saying over and over again, board games are good at what they do well and video games are good at what they do well. They're not really as interchangeable as some phone app makers want us to believe they are.
And I know we kind of pushed away at the start, but I do want to mention again, I do believe there's lessons to be learned in board games and in how board games are designed that can be adapted to video games.
Well, definitely. I mean, a lot of video games are prototyped on paper first.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, XCOM being a perfect example of a game that was paper prototyped.
Hearthstone that's a way too obvious example, but Hearthstone was definitely another.
And I love how in board games the numbers are low, so you can do the math.
Yeah,
and,
that's
but
important.
But in video games, they feel like they want to give you the biggest numbers ever, when really they can just decide what those numbers mean. Mm. Sometimes I get mad because I'm like, why do video games ever use percentages when they can just make things round numbers? Like, could you think about how it works? Like, what's the point? Like, video games have a real coda focus and there's a difference there. But anyway,
yeah, there's a lot of reasons why, so let's just move on.
Okay. Oh, fine. I probably said something hypocritical. Anyway, I hope that answers your question, Tom, and that we haven't just gone mad.
No, I think we answered it. We answered that question.
Yeah. Nailed it. We're the best.
All right. Well, I think that brings us to the close of the Fastcast. If you like what we do, you can find our Facebook page at facebook.com/slowpokespodcast. Ask many more questions so we have many more topics to cover on future episodes. If you want to find us on Twitter, you can't. I deleted the account, so fuck off. No, we're at slowpokescast on Twitter. And our website is slowpokespodcast.com, where you can find absolutely everything else we do. John, what's our next game, though?
Yeah, so our next game is Volume, which is the second game by Mike
Bethel. Yeah, game number two by Mike Bethel. Game number one is a game that we've both played, Thomas Was Alone, one of the most awesome indie games I've played in a long time. Game number three is Subsurface Circular, which is also an amazingly good indie game. So Mike Bethel and the team at Bethel Games are batting 1,000 as far as I'm concerned, and Volume is the only one that we have not played. You haven't played that either, have you, John?
No. I don't know why I skipped it. I kind of heard about it and then forgot about it.
Yeah.
And then came back to it. I think mostly because I was playing a lot of other kind of stealth games, and I was like, oh, I don't need to play Volume. I'm playing these instead.
Yeah, so I think that's for me as well. Like, I wanted to play it. I just never really got around to it because stealth games of this type aren't really my forte. But I am excited for it because, like I said, Bethel Games have made nothing but great shit as far as I'm concerned so far. So I'm really, really excited for it.
And I hate to say it, but it was only until Subsurface Circular when I actually got on board the Bethel train and I have his face and his company's logo tattooed all over my body, the same way you do with Mass Effect.
Yep, that's a thing that's real that is definitely true.
Definitely. But yeah, no, I'm excited to play it and check it out and just see what this one is and what's new about it.
So join us next week for Volume. In the meantime, I have been David.
I have been John.
Thank you so much for joining us for the Fastcast.